First up, however, a story that might ring a few bells. We're returning to the storm around mandatory detention, particularly of children, and looking at what the fallout has been. Ask any refugee advocate, and they'll tell you that the effects of mandatory detention on asylum seekers go on for a long time after they've been physically released. My next guest is a lawyer and refugee advocate who was instrumental in the infamous case of the Badrai family, who after fleeing Iran ended up in both the Woomera and Villawood detention centres. If the family name sounds familiar, you'll soon remember why. Jackie Everett is with me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, Jackie, you've written a book about the case called The Bitter Shore. The Badrai family, and especially their son Cheyenne, became very famous. Remind us of their story.
The Badrai family came from Iran, where both the parents had really lovely lives, but they got a bit entangled in a political student uprising in one of the cities, and they had to leave Iran. And when they arrived in Australia, they were sent immediately to Villawood. To Woomera, where Cheyenne became very, very ill. He became traumatised, and they were transferred to Villawood. And when I met Cheyenne, I thought he was going to die. I didn't think there was any chance that he would survive. And from then on, it was a battle to get them out of detention and to get help for Cheyenne. And it's ended happily, that story, which is the really marvellous thing about it. They're a wonderful, strong, good family.
Fantastic. We'll get to where they are now in a little while. But first of all, how old was Cheyenne when you first met him, or when they first went into Woomera Detention Centre?
He was five. And when they actually arrived in Darwin, his father said to his mother, "Sahra, I have brought you to paradise." They saw this wonderful green place where the police were so kind to them, the Navy had been so wonderful to them, and then
They were rescued, weren't they, by the Navy in a storm?
Yes. Everything that can ever happen to the Badrais does happen to the Badrais. And they were then taken, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, in two chartered planes to Villawood, and that's when they started becoming a bit worried about what was happening because they couldn't see anything below them, and they weren't even sure if they were in Australia. And they arrived at a very bad time. At Villawood, it was at Woomera. It was overcrowded, and it was not very well resourced. And nobody really knew what they were doing. And there was violence. And Cheyenne just seemed always to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and to see people threatening suicide, to see a man who'd slashed his wrists and slashed his throat and his wrists and see the bandages, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
And he was five.
He was five when it started. It reached a point where the psychologist, who was later in that year appointed, they arrived in March, and I think around about October or November, the prison company running Woomera employed a psychologist, and he actually reported Cheyenne to FASE, which is the community welfare service, like the DOCS equivalent, in Adelaide, as being an abused child because of what was happening there. Nothing to do with his parents, of course.
It was what was happening in the detention centre.
Yes.
You were immediately drawn to their case. You even rashly promised to get them out of detention at the very first meeting. Is that right?
I did. It was terribly self-indulgent. I couldn't believe it. All I could think is, this is the child of Middle Eastern boat people. Because of the way he arrived in this country, he's seen as a lesser being and nobody wants to protect him. I couldn't believe that the staff in there hadn't spoken out. I couldn't believe that the public servants handling the case hadn't spoken out. I saw a child. I don't have any medical experience, so I don't know if I overreacted, but I saw a child who looked so close to death. And if he'd been my child, I knew that I'd shout and scream and I would get help. Mm. And his parents were helpless. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't even get a doctor to see him unless it was agreed by the prison company that they could. I'm not saying that medical attention was late on a sort of, I suppose, a basic level. was withheld, but it was pretty bad.
Right. So let's talk a little more about his parents. You write that this is a family love story of remarkable depth. Zahra and Saeed met when she was 26. He was a Kurd, a non-Muslim. He was divorced and he already had Cheyenne. The circumstances were somewhat stacked against them, even in Iran, and so they fled. Is that what the background is?
That's part of it, but there was also a pro-democracy movement going on within the universities, and he was at a university at that stage.
It's a Saeed.
Saeed, yes, yeah. And he'd become involved just to a little extent. He wasn't rabidly political or anything like that, but he, because he'd always been disadvantaged because of his own religion, he has a strong sense of fairness and standing up for yourself in a quiet way. And so that was really the catalyst that sent them,
yes,
and looking for the people smugglers.
And there was also, wasn't there, pardon me, some difficulty between the fact that he was a non-Muslim and Zahra was, of course, a Muslim, and they were married.
Yes, she'd been brought up quite traditionally and came from a very strong Muslim family. Her father had learnt the Quran off by heart by the age of 6 or 7 or something. And she came from a huge family. And so that was quite a big issue because in the Democratic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, religion is not a choice. It's not a matter of choice. You're born there and that's the religion and you're expected to follow. And although there is tolerance for religions that predate Islam, there's not for ones that came later. And Saeed's religion is a sort of a grey area there. It's not one of the accepted religions.
Yeah. And apostasy is punishable by death, I think you say in your book.
It is. Right. And proselytising and apostasy, yes. And Iran is one of the three biggest executing countries, and we don't really know the figures, but it's even on the net. Executions are on the net. It's very, very distressing, really.
So it's understandable why they headed for Australia, as you say. So how did they arrive in Australia and what happened when they got here?
They went to a people smuggler and they came on a small boat, as many people did at that stage, having no idea that detention awaited them, none whatsoever. They thought they would be taken somewhere, they'd be there for a few days while their papers, while they were processed, and then they'd be let out into the community and they'd begin a life. Which they really did think that they'd lost any hope of doing in Iran. And it didn't work like that. There was a storm at sea and they were picked up by the Navy, who treated them so well. And I've often asked them about that. Were you scared? And for some reason they weren't scared during that storm. Their people smuggler hadn't overloaded the boat. At that time, there were a lot of overloaded boats coming. Theirs was actually quite successful.
And the family, as you said, were taken then from this rather nice experience of Australia straight to Woomera, where Cheyenne witnessed all these appalling events and became more and more deeply disturbed as time went on. And eventually, the family were transferred to Villawood. But things didn't improve very much for Cheyenne.
No.
He was repeatedly hospitalised, I believe.
Yes, and that's another interesting thing. He was taken to hospital 9 times. He was actually in hospital at one stretch for, I think it was 59 days or 53 days. But this was precipitated by seeing yet another aversive event, and he saw a man who slashed his wrist, and he saw the blood coming and falling to the floor, and he was with another little boy, and that was what sent him into a catatonic state. Although they call it voluntary mutism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like some biblical visitation. It's quite scary to think that a child would stop eating, drinking, speaking. He didn't even want to weight bear. He didn't want to walk. He didn't want to do anything, and he was in a little ball, a little fetal ball in bed, and on his bed. And his parents really, they were powerless. They could take him to the clinic, which they did, and the doctor was fine. The psychologist at Villawood was wonderfully supportive, but he was hamstrung. Nobody really knew what they could do. And it was after this event that he was taken to hospital, but he was not taken for assessment and treatment. He'd been sent from Woomera for hospital for treatment for his suspected post-traumatic stress disorder, but was never sent to hospital. He was only sent for rehydration, and each time he was sent for rehydration, which seems to be the great tragedy in the whole thing, because all the doctors recommended that Cheyenne should be out of detention immediately. The CEO of Westmead Children's Hospital wrote to the minister, who was then Mr. Philip Ruddock, and the head of psychiatry, Dr. David Dossiter, who was treating Cheyenne, who was the head of the team treating Cheyenne, he wrote to the minister. People in the Department of Immigration wrote to the minister. And it didn't seem to make any difference. These were all regarded as Section 417s, which is a letter requesting the minister to exercise his humanitarian discretion, which he has under the law. At all times he can exercise his own discretion, and at all times he said no. And I've seen most of them. I think I've seen an awful lot of them, and they're all no, no, no. Mm-hmm. A lot of them two or three of them are hand annotated. And there seems to have been some idea that developed within the minister's office that Saeed was making up his son's illness. I'm not quite sure how he could have duped all the doctors. I'm not sure how you could stop a child eating. In fact, I know you can't. And I'm not sure how you could stop a child talking, how you could make him rock in a fetal ball or any of those things. And what the other thing that was quite interesting, it appears that people within power decided that Cheyenne hadn't witnessed these events, yet all the events are documented and the incident reports are written, and then there's a crossover with the medical reports with Cheyenne appearing. At some of them he was seen witnessing the events. His drawings showed everything, showed the man with the blood and all these things, yet I don't understand why people who'd never been there decided that this was some kind of fabrication.
Yeah. And no wonder you made your promise when you first met him then that you would get the man of mandatory detention. And I'm speaking with Jackie Everett about the case of the Bad Drive family. You did live up to your promise, didn't you? Because you wrote about the case in the press, and there was a powerful Four Corners program on the family and on Cheyenne's plight. What did make a difference in the end to the Bad Drive family?
The Bad Drive family were very, very lucky. Angels in Australia just came from everywhere to support them. A friend of mine who works with refugees, Narita Russell, found a barrister, Dr. Stephen Churches, who was prepared to take their case pro bono to the full federal court. Debbie Whitmont, after I wrote my story in the Herald, which I have to say had minimal effect, apart from to bring Debbie Whitmont, to put Debbie and I in contact, and Debbie was in the middle already of doing a program on Four Corners with refugees. And so we decided that we had to get a camera into Villawood, and I was absolutely happy to do that. I had no qualms of breaking a regulation. It's not a law. I don't know where that idea came from. People ask me how I dared break the law, but it wasn't breaking the law at all. And everyone was adamant that Australians needed to see this child and see what was going on inside the camps. And it was the first time ever. I later did it in Port Hedland as well. But to my knowledge, they're the only two cameras that have ever been in to show what's not sanitised. In fact, at all, I don't think there've been any other cameras. And the footage was absolutely harrowing. I've actually never been able to watch it since the first time. I can't watch any of that because it just brings it back so strongly.
And eventually it had, getting Australians up in arms about it, did have the desired effect. So take us up to the present. How is Cheyenne and his family now?
They are the most astonishing family. We took a compensation claim for Cheyenne because we were not... Cheyenne's life will definitely be affected by what happened to him, and I think all our doctors were fairly certain of that. And we succeeded in the compensation claim, and that was Maurice Blackburn who put huge resources behind it. And today I'm looking at, I see this family all the time, we speak two or three times a week. They are just fantastic. Shabnam, who was born in Australia under the most...
That's Cheyenne's little sister?
Yes.
Yes.
She's eight now. She was born under the most amazing conditions, and actually it's a miracle that she's alive. It's a shocking story. Cheyenne himself is at a wonderful school with a fantastic headmistress. I mean, it's such a success story. I feel like Pollyanna going through it now. Dorothy Hodnott, who's the headmistress of Holroyd High School, and her staff are quite extraordinary. Mm. So he's getting the best education you can get in Australia. And his mother has been running family daycare. She went to TAFE and she did training, and she did volunteer work organised by Trish Highfield, another friend. And so she has a little United Nations of children in her house, and she rings me and says, "Oh, Jackie, you'll be so jealous. I've got two babies sitting on my knee." And Saeed is painting houses, and he actually, when we were renovating my daughter's flat, I rang him and said, "Please help." And he came and did the whole thing, and I cannot say how beautifully he did it. So I would call this one of the best success stories. If they had just come as immigrants, Australia would be very pleased to have them. And I think that Shabnam says, "I'm an Aussie," because she was born here, and this is a source of great pride. And they've got wonderful friends. They've kept their Australian friends. In some ways, detention was lucky for them because they met a lot of Australian people, and that was a nice easing.
And it's nice to hear something positive came out of that horrible story, and it is an extraordinary story. It's so fantastic to hear that the family is doing well. Thank you so much, Jackie Everett, for coming in and telling us about it. And, of course, your book, The Bitter Shore, is available now, I presume?
Yes, I think it's in bookshops.
Fantastic.
And thank you very much, Jane. It was lovely to be able to speak about this story.
Well, it's both devastating and at the end wonderful to hear about what's happened. It feels sometimes like Australia doesn't deserve families like the Bad Dries. So lawyer, refugee advocate and writer Jackie Everett, we've been speaking to her, and The Bitter Shore is published by Pan Macmillan.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.